and friends. I'm Val.
I'm Courtney.
And I'm Lisa.
And this is My Perfect Romance.
Bow, chicka, bow, bow.
What about all over you?
Or how about my sweet love?
I think we all have a different idea about what romance is.
Well, what is the perfect romance?
Gosh, I don't know, but let's find out.
Welcome back, romance lovers, to another episode of My Perfect Romance. I'm Val.
I'm Lisa.
And I'm Courtney.
Today, we are beyond thrilled to welcome a truly phenomenal voice in contemporary romance. She is an author, a senior lecturer in writing, literature, and culture, and the president of the International Association for the Study of Popular Romance.
That is amazing. And as one of the world's foremost scholars in romance, Jodi has conducted extensive research on representations of love, sex, and women in popular culture and fiction, making her a formidable authority on all things romance, and her novels certainly live up to her accolades. You may recognize her as the author of An Academic Affair and the Marry Me, Juliet trilogy.
But today, we're here to discuss her upcoming novel, A Study in Sparkling. Please welcome Dr. Jodi McAllister to the show. Welcome.
Oh, that's so kind. What a lovely introduction. Thank you so much.
I am curious, what type of research did you do? Like, what was your primary thesis when you were working on your PhD?
So my PhD is cross-disciplinary. It was half and half between English, so literary studies, and history. So my PhD was on the representations of female virginity loss and the way they intersect with narratives of love in popular culture. So about half of it was about romance fiction. There was a chapter on historical romance, there was a chapter on Harlequin, and there was a chapter on not so much Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey as the reviews of Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey.
That is fascinating. Had to have 50 Shades in Twilight in there for sure.
Yes. Oh, yeah, of course, obviously.
What an interesting topic. That is just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like we could have a whole podcast on that. That's amazing.
Can we?
I know.
No, I mean, sure, there's a book that came out of this. This is all my first academic book, which is called The Consummate Virgin, Female Virginity Loss and Love in Anglophone Popular Literatures, which I sort of turned my, we call it thesis, you would call it dissertation in the US. I turned it into a book.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. Amazing. As you should, because that's fascinating.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. I'm just really lucky that we got to read your book. I absolutely adore wine. And so my husband and I, we have our own wine cellar and everything. And so it was really wonderful to see your expertise on wine combined with your extensive knowledge on romance in your new book, A Study in Sparkling. And I just really enjoyed it. It was a very emotional, raw book. And I loved how it revolved around themes of being kept a secret, with the main heroine of the story realizing that she was part of a second family, as well as she's coming and healing from that experience and developing a new relationship with a younger man. So what drew you to explore the different facets of secrecy and romance?
So one of my favorite things to do as an author is to take an incredibly high concept premise and think about what it would actually feel like, what that would actually look like, what that would actually do to you as a person. Mm-hmm. So with my previous book, An Academic Affair, the kind of high concept premise I took was marriage of convenience, which in a contemporary setting is very hard to make that feel realistic. But I was like, oh, okay, well, how would this actually work? And then what would that actually do? How would that actually feel? And so here, the kind of big soap operatic swing is that Fiona's husband leaves her for a secret second family. And I mean, that's such Bold and the Beautiful nonsense, you know? Mm-hmm. But then I thought about, how would that make you feel? The fact that you were this dirty little secret for 13 years of your life and you had no idea. And it's not just you that has been abandoned, but also your children. And so obviously you would be deeply hurt, you would be deeply betrayed. But what I landed on is that more than anything else, you would probably feel really, really embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought about this as a book about embarrassment in many ways, particularly for Fiona, who is the heroine. So she has been so profoundly humiliated by what her husband has done to her that not just the thought of dating, being able to trust someone, that is one hurdle she has to get past. But Satoshi is someone that she knows. So that is actually a little bit easier for her to work through than the thought of people knowing that she's dating again. And because Satoshi is younger than her, and on paper it looks like such a terrible idea, she kind of finds herself back in this place where she doesn't want people to know what she's doing because she doesn't want to get humiliated all over again. There's a line in the book where she says, "I had no desire to hand anyone the hammer they could use to break me ever again." And she's not talking so much about Satoshi there, but about the world, because it could so easily go horribly, horribly wrong. And Satoshi, on the other hand, is younger than her and has some insecurity around not being taken seriously. So he is quite young for how good he is at his job. So he is studying to be a master sommelier, but he's got this older brother who he feels like will never really treat him as an adult. His brother is 12 years older than him, so it's a significant age gap. And so he's got this constant anxiety about proving himself, about being taken seriously. And when Fiona is like, "Oh, can we keep this on the DL for a while?" Intellectually, he understands why, but it doesn't mean that it hurts any less emotionally. So the secrecy in this book really kind of tied into those themes of embarrassment and humiliation to me. Like, how do you come back from such an embarrassing thing happening to you?
Yeah,
absolutely. I love the realness of your book. I mean, because we always talk about this after we read or watch a movie. How realistic is this romance? And I felt your characters were so real, and the emotions they were feeling, you just captured it so well. Like you said, the embarrassment, and feeling like you're not good enough maybe for somebody. You just really did such a great job.
Well, and one aspect that I don't see, and you probably know this better than I do, but you don't come across this very much in literature. And I think it's so important because it's something that's so relatable and so many people go through, is when you have had kids and you go through this massive betrayal, not only do you lack trust in the world around you, but you're like, okay, if I let somebody in, there's the potential that they could not only break my heart, but my kids. And as a mom, you're protecting those kids more than anything. And so I really loved that aspect that you did bring in, because it's not something that we see very often in literature, especially in romance, because it's all about that flame and that, you know, like, eroticism or whatever. But in this book, you kept it real. And I really, really appreciated it. How did you go about, you know, just finding that balance between like being protective of the kids while at the same time, like, they had a passionate, you know, romance?
Yeah.
Like, how did you do that?
Yeah, it was really hard. And I thought a lot about this. I talked to a lot of my mom friends about how to do this and about kind of figuring out the emotional realities of this. And I realized that in setting Satoshi up as Fiona's love interest, it would be too much for the book to handle if he didn't already know her kids. So I had to have a kind of slightly lower barrier to entry there. If she had to introduce this whole new man to these three children that she has, particularly her oldest, Lex, is so, so angry about what their father has done. Satoshi already needed to be in their lives for me to be able to get them to their happy ending in the space that I had in this romance narrative. Because Fiona is so hesitant to trust anyone again that I don't think there's any way she'd be letting a whole brand new person in. And I thought a lot when I set up the character of Fiona in the book previous to this, An Academic Affair, about who I would pair her with. And there is no way, given what she's been through, I could do like an enemies to lovers with Fiona. Fiona can't stand not being liked at the moment. Yes. She is not in a place where she can handle that.
Yeah.
And so she needed someone who would be so kind to her, so patient, so gentle. And the way, more than anything, that Satoshi kind of finds his way in with her, that she can trust that he is who he says he is, that he is kind and patient and gentle, is that he has consistently demonstrated this with her kids over a longer period of time with no sort of ulterior motive. So he's been doing this since long before her terrible husband made his big reveal. So Satoshi is a queer character. He's pansexual. And Fiona's eldest child, Lex, is queer as well. They're non-binary. And so building in that relationship between Lex and Satoshi, where Satoshi is sort of Lex's queer hero and helps Fiona navigate their coming out a little bit, that was really important for me to be able to help Fiona let Satoshi in. Otherwise, like, this book takes place over about 5 months. It would have taken 5 years otherwise to get Fiona where she needed to go.
Yeah. Well, how do you think the judgment Fiona and Satoshi experience affects the way they appreciate or approach relationships, intimacy, and commitment?
I think it really affects them now. So perhaps in the past, it wasn't so big a factor, particularly for Satoshi. I think in the past, Satoshi is a lover boy. You know, he loves love. He is a serial monogamist as well. Like when Satoshi loves you, he really, really loves you. And so I think some of those relationships he's been desperately clinging on to kind of prove his worth, but it hasn't really activated his same insecurities as the kind of secret on the side business with Fiona really had. So one of the relationships of his that we cover in the book is his relationship with his ex-boyfriend Kieran, which Satoshi maybe clung on to for a little bit too long because he is such a lover boy and he really wants to be loved. He wants to be seen. He wants to be valued. He wants to be respected. He wants to be adored. When Fiona married her husband, she was really young. She was 21, 22, and a lot of it was rebellion. And so it was a bit of a screw you, her marriage, really. Her family were like, no, don't do this. This is a terrible idea. And she was like, I don't care what you think. I want to do this. I'm going to do it anyway. And part of the humiliation for where she is now is that she has to admit that her family were right. And oh, like, poor girl has her pride. You know, she is already what she feels like the kind of disappointment in her family. She comes from this very academic family where her dad has a PhD. Both her brothers have PhDs. Even though her brothers don't mean to, they sometimes accidentally make her feel really, really stupid. Mm-hmm. And so in a relationship, finding someone who's willing to meet her where she's at. And one thing Satoshi does that does for her that she never hears from people around her is that he's proud of her. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of Fiona's insecurity feeds directly into this relationship really profoundly in that way. And he is both a balm to her in many ways, but also because she's so conscious of what they look like on paper, it also kind of triggers some of her insecurities as well.
Yep. Well, one thing I also like is through this process is they are both learning about wine as they're kind of going through the story. And we already know that going for his master sommelier. But you also see how he encourages her to embrace her knowledge and to gain more skills and learn more things. And throughout your novel, it's really interesting to see how you describe the wine and you really show kind of Fiona's confidence growing with her knowledge about the wine. And you see that her confidence in herself and is growing as she's also learning about the wine. Satoshi is helping her grow in her knowledge for the wine. She's also growing in her confidence as a person. And they sort of have a vinification process as they're going through this falling in love. These characters do these wonderful arcs. Which character was the most fulfilling for you to write? Was there a particular hurt that you wanted them to overcome? Was there a scene that was difficult for you? That's kind of a lot of questions, but
yeah. So Fiona's arc was always really clear to me in this book. When I sat down to write this, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with her. I knew because both Fiona and Satoshi are set up in an academic affair, but she in particular has a bigger role in that book. So I knew exactly where she was and exactly the kind of big hurdle that she needed to overcome, which was, as I've talked about, this kind of embarrassment. Like Fiona needs to be able to trust, and she needs to kind of find the boldness to love in public again. And I don't know if she'll ever stop completely fearing that one day the rug might get pulled out from under her again. But if there's one person you could trust with your heart, it is little sweetheart Satoshi. Like he is never going to let you down like that. So I knew what that arc would need to look like. And I thought about her as sort of being like a baby deer, like a Bambi on kind of newborn legs, just really trying to get back to her feet. And his role is that he's always there holding his hand out, being like, I'll help you. Whatever you need, I will help you. Mm-hmm. And Satoshi's arc was harder. And that probably made it ultimately more fulfilling because I really had to kind of work to kind of crack the spine of that narrative and figure out what I needed it to do. And one of the problems I had in writing this book is that Fiona and Satoshi are both so fundamentally, they're both good people. They're both lovely. They're both invested in being kind to each other, even if they do sometimes accidentally not always succeed in that regard. And so when you have a romance between two people who are so kind and who do like so genuinely like each other, you have a lack of conflict. And so working out what the central conflict for Satoshi would be was quite difficult because I didn't want to just make him like a manic pixie wine boy who just was surprised there to, fulfill every need of Fiona's and everything was going to be fine, actually. I wanted to make him more of a person than that. Like, And so what I thought about is, what is your biggest flaw if you are so kind? And it's with Satoshi, it's that he consistently sublimates his own needs because he is either so desperate to be taken seriously, or he's so desperate to give Fiona what she wants because he loves her so much. And that's not a spoiler. Like the first line of the book is Satoshi says, I fell in love with Fiona Fisher Sinclair at about 7 p.m. on a Tuesday. So we begin with him falling head over heels in love with him. And so Satoshi is a people pleaser. And so once I figured that out, that whole arc for him, his whole narrative fell into place and it gave it a lot more shape. And I'm really happy with how it turned out in the end.
I really like how you took him full too. At the beginning, I was starting to wonder, I was like, okay, is he going to? And then you did a beautiful job with him. I was super happy with how that worked out. I was just like, made me smile because my husband is very much a very kind Satoshi type character. And so it was like, oh, it was really sweet to see him gain the confidence to ask for what he needed too. And I thought that was beautiful.
Yeah, you can't help love Fiona and Satoshi. They are to the core beautiful humans and you're rooting for them the whole time. Mm-hmm. And it just propels you to keep reading because you want things to work out between them so much because they are such lovely people and all you want for them is to be together and have a life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like how you also have them, they're real characters too, like especially like Fiona is not clean during this process. She makes mistakes. And I love that your characters, even when they make mistakes, they have accountability and they step up really praying for these two beautiful people to get together. It's not that it's always going to be perfect. It's that they're going to be human with each other. They're going to try to build each other up. They're going to have problems and have to own mistakes. And they do that. And it's really neat to see them growing throughout this entire process and supporting each other. And I loved how you paralleled it with the wine.
It's important to me that they make mistakes because particularly Fiona, you're not going to know how to come out of what she's been through. Like who would know how to react when you've been betrayed like that? So she's failing, or she talks about herself as a mess at the beginning. And so she doesn't really know what she's doing. And Satoshi is so desperately in love with her, he's terrified to put a foot wrong. So
yeah,
for all that they are so invested in being kind to each other, they're also on tiptoes a lot of the time. And when you're on tiptoes, you're going to fall over.
Well, and with the character arcs for each of them, like she had this serious betrayal of being kept someone's dirty little secret. But then yet she turns around and kind of does the same thing. And absolutely. I was like, what a cruel thing to do. Mm-hmm. To Satoshi, when she knows how bad it hurt her, but you understand why she's doing it. It's just, mm-hmm. I mean, how do you decide, like, what kind of cruel things you're going to put your characters through for them to grow at their best? Like, as you're going through that writing process.
Well, I suppose part of the work of being a romance writer is putting your characters in situations where they're going to react dramatically. Otherwise, you have no tension in your story. One of the reasons why Fiona is like, oh, Satoshi, can we keep this on the DL? There's one, she's worried about how people will talk about her. Because if you have been, you know, married for all this time and then your husband ditches you and then the next person you're seen with is this, you know, hot younger man, everyone's going to be like, oh, babe, you're getting set up to get your heart broken again. So there's a reason for her there. But there's also a reason, you know, she's doing this for him as well. She thinks that he wouldn't want to be seen with her. He wouldn't want to be associated with her. And when he first kind of offers to maybe help her get back on her feet sexually, she thinks he's doing it out of pity, out of compassion. Mm-hmm. She fundamentally doesn't believe that such a, you know, a lovely hot boy would be interested in someone like her. And so it's rooted in a weird kind of perverse kindness, even as it seems like this very cruel thing to do.
Absolutely. But I love how you actually have her, I think part of her healing with her husband was her working through that and seeing the parallels between that relationship with him and what she was doing in her relationship. And she owned it in a way that I don't feel like her ex ever did in the story. Like, she did a much better job of owning such a smaller version of it. And in understanding that process, I think it helped give her the freedom to set it free. And I just thought that was so beautifully done. Had she not been the one to identify and approach the problem, I don't think that the characters would have resolved and had the growth arcs that they both had in that situation. And so I just thought that was so well done.
Yeah, the character arcs were beautiful in this story. And that's what I come to books for. I'm like, I want to see growth, damn it. And you did it. So thank you
very much.
Switching gears a little bit, I'm just curious. I love to read a book, not only that shows growth, but that I get to learn something that I've never experienced or I know nothing about. I was truly shocked by, like, all the work that goes into becoming a master sommelier. I didn't know that was a thing. I don't know what kind of research you had to do, but I would love a little insight as to, like, your research process for the winemaking and the sommelier, becoming a master sommelier. I don't even know if I'm saying that word right. That's how little I know. Fill me in.
I did a lot of research for this book, and people always ask me if I do research for my books. And for the past four, I've been like, no, because they were rooted in things that I had already done the research for. So, which is, you know, probably the answer isn't a straightforward no. But for instance, my Marry Me Juliet trilogy, which came out before An Academic Affair, all take place on the same season of a show, which is not called The Bachelor for legal reasons, but it's basically The Bachelor. And I have written a great deal of academic work about The Bachelor. So the research came pre-prepared. This is the first book that I've had to actually kind of go out and do some new work for. And oh no, it was about wine. How sad for me. So I went to Melbourne Wine School and I worked through three levels of the Wine, Spirits and Education Trust courses. I finished level three earlier this year. This is nowhere near the level of qualification that Satoshi does. The Master Sommelier exam is the hardest exam in the world. That's not an exaggeration. It literally is. Like, 5% of people who sit it take it. And there is a a whole cuvee of champagne that is reported to taste like failure because they always serve it at the reception where the new master sommelier exams, the new master sommeliers are announced, which means that most of the people in the room have just failed the exam.
Oh.
So this is a brutal, really, really difficult exam. Think about it as sort of the PhD of wine, but maybe even tougher. I was nowhere near that level, but by going along to school every Sunday, I was able to really build up my knowledge of, you know, not just kind of the major wine regions of the world and the major grapes, but also about kind of wine as an art form and wine as a medium for telling story. So if you know how to smell and you know how to taste, there is a whole story in every glass of wine, and learning how to identify that activated this whole other part of my brain. Like I spend most of my time sitting at my desk, but, you know, using my sense of smell and my sense of taste allowed me to kind of think in this whole other way. And so when I, you know, had this realization of like what a storytelling mechanism wine is, it really helped click sort of the wine aspects of this book together for me, which is why there are little tasting notes at the beginning of each chapter, because every glass of wine tells a story.
Yeah. I absolutely love those. I like wine, so I found it super delightful reading all of those little tidbits throughout it. I was just like a beautiful Easter egg hidden within a super well-written novel. It was lovely.
Yeah, that was a really fun part.
So I'm interested, if you were to write about Satoshi's future after becoming a sommelier, what would that look like? What happens when you become a sommelier?
Yeah, so if he became an MS, Master Sommelier, I think he has no appetite to leave his business, his bar that he has set up. A lot of Master Sommeliers are working in, say, very, very elite fine dining restaurants or doing consultancy and things like that. I think he would perhaps do a little bit more consultancy. He maybe wouldn't be on the floor of his bar quite so much. You know, he would help rich people set up their wine cellars, things like that. But he wants the qualification because he wants to be able to say that he's an MS. This is part of his drive to, you know, prove himself, more so than he wants to change careers. I think he really loves the little bar that he set up, Tsudoku, which is a high-end wine bar, but also a bookstore. It's a romance novel, so spoilers, he and Fiona end up together. You know, he has no desire to travel and leave her and the three kids behind either.
By the way, I love the name. Will you tell our listeners the name of Satoshi's, what the meaning is?
Yes.
Behind Satoshi's bar.
Yeah. So his bar is called Tsundoku, and this is the Japanese word for letting books pile up in your house unread. So think about it as a very spectacular TBR pile.
I have a few of those piles in my house.
Oh, we all I do too, guilty as charged. Well, I love it. There's a word for that. That's such a cool concept for like a wine bar.
Yeah.
To let it be just like a reading safe haven community gathering place. Like, what a cool place.
I want that in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
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 I love that.
And they were like, "I'm in Tasmania. I'm in Hobart. Where's the bar?" And I was like, "Oh, sorry, babe, it's not real. I made it up.
I want it to be real so badly."
I do too.
Yeah,
I would pretty much live there.
Yes,
we all would.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can see why Fiona was such a regular.
Yes.
Totally.
We consider you an expert who studies romance in popular culture professionally. Your unique perspective as an author brings an interesting layer to your work. How does it shape your view of romance overall?
Well, that is a really good question. So I always think of my career as like a double helix, like DNA. So if you pulled out the author strand, I think the scholar strand would collapse. And if you pulled out the scholar strand, I think the author strand would collapse. I think for me, they are really, really deeply intertwined. And the way I approach writing romance is so deeply informed by my knowledge of romance and also my kind of ongoing exploration and research into sort of what love is, what love stories we tell, what those love stories do to the way that we think. And to kind of build on that DNA image, there's a scholar I really like called Jayashree Kamble, who defines the romance novel as also like DNA,
where one strand is novel, what we think of as a novel at any given point in time, and one strand is romance, where it's what we consider romantic at any given point in time. And when I kind of, you know, sit back and look at the romance genre and I think about it as a, you know, a body of text that's also kind of a series of cultural artifacts, I think there's so much we can learn there about what we consider romantic at a given moment in time. And it's also made me think about what I think is romantic. And to invoke another scholar, there's another scholar I like called David Shumway, who identifies two discourses of romance. There's one that he calls a romance, but I think passion is maybe a better word for, where love is something that happens to you. Love is uncontrollable. It bowls in, it mows you over, you fall into it, and there's sort of nothing you can do about it. You're almost quite a passive in this sense. But then there's also intimacy, which is love as something that happens between lovers. Love is something you work on, something that you do together. And while I think passion has a great place in romance fiction, and indeed this might be what happens to Satoshi right at the beginning of the book when he's like, oh, I'm in love with her, oh my goodness, as this sudden realization out of nowhere. For me, I always gravitate to books where intimacy kind of comes to the fore, where we have this emphasis on love as something that you have to try at. It's not like, oh, we're in love now and everything is magical. It's love is something you do. Love is something you choose every day. And so when Satoshi falls in love with Fiona at the beginning of this book, he doesn't just go, well, I'm in love with her, that's the end. He, even when she's still married, he tries to show her this constantly, to do love at her all the time, even though he has no hope of ever being with her. And this is the thing that they have to work out over the course of the book is, how do we be together? How can we, you know, perform love the best way we can? How can we make this connection we have actually romantic? And intimacy is about a deep knowing of the other person. And as they kind of come to know each other better and better, the more intimate that connection becomes. And that to me is sort of the most powerfully romantic version of the romance narrative. And I love it when I see it in other books.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what was the spark that made you want to write this particular novel?
Well, one, I wanted to write a book about wine. Like it's pretty simple. My last book is about universities, which is also, I work in universities and I love my work as an academic, but do I have some thoughts about the modern neoliberal managerial university? Like maybe I do. So I was like, what if I wrote a book that's about something I really love? And as soon as sort of Satoshi turned up on the page in an academic affair, I was like, oh, he's for Fiona. I invented him just for Fiona. There we go. But really the kind of narrative starting point was this idea about embarrassment that I was telling you about. Like when I sort of wrote Fiona into an academic affair, as soon as I was like, okay, Jonah has this sister and she's been through this thing. And as soon as that concept clicked, I knew I had to have a Fiona book because I love that big soap operatic moment being treated in this quite like granular, realistic way. It's just my favorite thing.
So just out of curiosity, is there going to be any other books related to the Fiona Satoshi world?
Yes, there is. I'm about 90,000 words into the third one in the series.
Oh, wow.
It's about Sadie's sister, Chess. And if you look carefully, you can see who her partner will be. It is hidden, but not hidden that way.
That's exciting.
Yes, it is.
All right. Little Easter.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely figurable, outerable.
I think I might have an idea. Okay, sorry.
We'll wait and see. We won't make you spill the beans yet, but we're looking forward to the beans.
Yeah.
So I have to laugh because you love wine. Like my husband loves coffee. Like if you could write a book about, because there's so much to know about the coffee world, he'll like tell me things and I'm like, woo, that went right over my head.
Her husband picks the best coffee. Like it is incredible. Like I have had coffee drinking moments that I'm like, what is this amazing cup of heaven in front of me? Yes. Yeah.
Some of his
coffee
tastes
like
free soda.
He gave me the best coffee of my life, and him and I still talk about it as the Holy Grail coffee, and you cannot get it anymore. And we had this entire conversation one day while we were building a deck about do we regret having had that coffee now that we know what, you know, the hand of God tastes like?
I've got some wines that I feel like that about that are so expensive that I'm like, oh, you know, I got to try like a third of a glass. Now I'm going to be thinking about it for my entire life.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
It's so cool.
You're going to have to live with that.
Well, I'm curious now, out of one of those wines, what story would you tell that would let us know what it tasted like? If you were Fiona telling us a story about one of those amazing wines.
About your best sip of wine.
This wine that I'm talking about is a Chardonnay. It's by a producer in Beechworth in Australia called Giaconda. And this is widely regarded to be Australia's best Chardonnay. You can only buy it on allocation and it sells out in like 15 seconds or something like that. Like it's super in demand. And when I got to try it, the first thing that it reminded me of was a match being struck. And that's how it felt. Like the wine was a spark. And that struck match character comes from the oak. It's the char inside of the barrel. And so first you get this sense that this like this wine is coming alight. And then beyond that, the fruit is so rich and so layered and so delicate, moving from orchard fruit to stone fruit to a little bit of tropical fruit. But it's restrained. It's not like a fruit bulb of a wine. You can tell it's been treated with care and with love. And it's been treated carefully and delicately and patiently, the way that perhaps Satoshi treats Fiona.
I love it. Well, now we're going to be thinking about that wine.
It's the last thing I think about before I go to sleep every night is when can I try Jake on the Chardonnay again?
I love it. That's a great way to fall asleep.
Dreaming of wine.
Right? Okay. So one of my favorite things to do as I'm reading a book is try to picture in my mind, if this character were to be played on the silver screen, who would be playing this character? So as you are writing this book, who would you cast as Fiona and who would you cast as Satoshi?
I'm going to have a really disappointing answer to this question, which is... not even remotely visual. You can probably tell this from some of the descriptions in my book of characters. It'll be like, yeah, you'll probably get their hair color and you might get one other characteristic. Like Fiona has brown hair and she's got some freckles and that is all you're ever going to know about her. Satoshi dyes his hair blonde and he wears fun, colorful glasses. He's quite tall. End of things you know about Satoshi. And I think should this book be adapted to the screen, what I would love is a kind of a heated rivalry situation where it was kind of unknown actors who become elevated to stardom because they embody Fiona and Satoshi. And ideally, of course, I would love that to be Australian actors. I will, though, give a shout out to the narrators of my audiobook who capture both these characters so well. So Sophia Lett plays Fiona and Sen Mitsuji plays Satoshi, and they just absolutely nail it. So, I don't know if either of them do scream, but, you know, maybe they want to make the journey over.
I'm always so impressed by the way that even just listening to audiobooks and how the narrators emote so well, it just brings it to a different level.
Yeah.
I'll have to give it a listen though.
So we also discuss how long we think the relationship is going to last between the two protagonists. I'm always 25 to life. And that's what I'm saying with these two. But this is our range. 1 day, 3 months, 2 years, 7 years, or 25 to life. What would you say?
Fiona and Satoshi are 25 to life.
Yes! That's what I say too.
There is a world where, you know, if they didn't kind of get over some of their issues during the course of this book, then it could have fizzled. It could have been 1 day and they both would have been very brokenhearted over this forever, probably, especially Satoshi. But now they've kind of sorted through it. They're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Yeah.
And I also like it. We talk about the spice factor, and I love how you take this sweet character Satoshi, but then you also make him super hot. He is younger than her, but he knows when to take charge, and I really enjoyed how you went about the sex scenes in this. I thought they were hot and that you gave such an authoritative power that was really exciting. So when you went to go write this novel, we also kind of like to talk about, like, is this a green pepper, a jalapeno, a cayenne, habanero, or a ghost? And I thought you hit this novel just right on the head for the amount of sexuality. It was very well written. It was hot, but it was also not meant to be what the novel was circulating around. So what spiciness level do you kind of consider your writing in this?
Yeah, I'd say this is a mild cayenne. I think we're a little bit beyond jalapeno here. I think we've moved up into kind of cayenne. But yeah, this is an erotic romance by any means. But the sex is really important to the story here. So this is kind of the way that Fiona and Satoshi's whole deal kind of kicks off, is that, you know, she is trying to put herself back together. And because of, you know, a conversation that they have, Satoshi offers to help her in a very particular arena. And that arena is sex. And this was, so they're sort of friends with benefits is kind of the way they fall into their relationship eventually. But it also was something that really helped clarify their character dynamic for me. So I was thinking about, like I mentioned before, I could never give Fiona an enemies to lovers kind of arc. Fiona needed someone who was going to be kind to her. But Fiona's probably not in a position where, like, because she's a single parent, she has decision fatigue. You know, she is constantly taking charge all the time. And I thought it might be quite helpful for her, particularly as she tries to kind of put herself back out there, if someone else would kind of do the heavy lifting. I don't think Fiona and Satoshi are ever going to fall into some kind of like dom sub relationship. Yeah. But making sure, like giving Satoshi this kind of sort of authoritative streak helped me realize that his central anxiety is not being taken seriously. Like, he is an adult. He does know what he wants. He's able to communicate this clearly. He is able to take charge. And he knows this about himself, and it is hugely frustrating to him when other people don't see that. And so the fact that Fiona responded so well to that, that was exactly what she needed, is, I think, an enduring sign of their compatibility.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So,
side note, another podcast that I was listening to, and I wish I could recall it off the top of my head, but it was a sex therapist that was just talking about like the main basic thing that he has to go over during his sex therapy sessions. And by the way, a male sex therapist is kind of a rare bird in that field, but he was just saying that just that thing, that women do want men to take charge because they do juggle so much. That's one area that they're like, yes, that is that's a big turn on for them. So it's like, yeah, that. So I felt like that was kind of a device to make it the spice turn up from jalapeno maybe to some cayenne.
Yeah. Books that I've published recently that I co-wrote with Athena Bellis is about audio erotica. And so we were looking at kind of the stuff that's on like Quinn and Dipsy and apps like that. And one of the most common forms of audio erotica there is what's called the boyfriend experience. But these often begin with these like scenes of domestic caretaking. The like, you don't have to worry about making dinner. I've done that. I've done the laundry. I've taken care of everything. Now let me take care of you. And I think
you guys, we got to stop here soon.
Ellery's getting hot and bothered now, talking about domestic responsibilities.
I mean, this is quite a profound fantasy for many women who are still working a second shift effectively. Like if you meet someone who will take things off your plate, who will like mean that you are not constantly trying to play 12-dimensional chess, working out, you know, how all the aspects of not just your life, but your family's life will fit together. This isn't to say that all women want to be ordered around in all aspects of their lives. I don't think that's true, but there certainly is a fantasy of someone just, you know, you not having to be the boss for once, or someone else just taking care of things for you and letting you relax, letting you not worry about that.
Yeah, it's pretty hot. I got Valerie a book. I don't know if you remember this, Val, but it was called Porn for Women. And it's a picture book of porn, and it's of men like taking out the garbage, vacuuming, sitting across with a glass of wine saying, how was your day?
It was so hot.
So it was a pretty, she got hot and bothered from that. I'll just tell you that.
I did. I was like, that was the sexiest book I've ever read in my entire life.
That was Ghost Pepper.
Yeah. And I'm like, what? Tell me how you want to know how I feel?
Yeah, that's like a million on the Scoville scale.
I love it. We like to talk about our favorite lines from books. When you were writing this book, was there a line that you're like, I have to get that in there one way or another? This is the central theme. This is the takeaway that I want people to get when they read this novel. Yeah. What would that be for you?
Yeah. So I also wanted the first line of this book to be, which is, you know, the book begins with Satoshi being like, I fell in love with Fiona at 7 p.m. on a Tuesday. I always knew I wanted to start there. But probably the line that became a refrain through this book, which is kind of a central thematic concern, is something Satoshi says repeatedly to Fiona, where she is worried that she is asking too much of him. That, you know, because she doesn't really believe that he would want to be with her. You know, she doesn't even really believe that he would want to be friends with her sometimes because he's so young and cool and she's just like some mom. And he tells her several times that there is nothing you can ask of me that I don't want to give you. And This is both exactly what Fiona needs to hear. So she has both, like, I have some beef with the concept of love languages, and that beef is mostly that some guy just made them up. There's no scientific basis in them. But if we're going to use the language of love languages, both Fiona and Satoshi are acts of service people. Mm. And so post her divorce, Fiona is being forced to accept help from a lot of people, and she feels really weird and guilty about it, and it's another kind of source of embarrassment. So Satoshi telling her that, look, there's nothing you can ask of me that I don't actively want to give you, really kind of a relief for her. It is assuaging because she feels like she is imposing on everyone all the time. But it is also an indication of Satoshi's kind of fatal flaw, which is that he will give and give and give and give and give because he wants so desperately to make her happy. He's too nice. He's too kind. And sometimes he needs to remember to put his own oxygen mask on first. And so this is the kind of the thing that he has to work through. And Fiona also has to work through at the end of the book is what do they ask of each other as partners, as lovers? What's that going to look like going forward?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I love that part for sure.
Yeah.
It made me think of a little bit the refrain from Princess Bride, as you wish.
It is a bit as you wishy, isn't it?
I absolutely love that.
Well, Jody, where can our listeners find you if they want to keep up with your writing journey or find out what's coming up after A Study in Sparkling drops September 15th?
So you can go to my website, which is jodymcallister.com.au. But in terms of social media, probably the best place to find me is Instagram. That's where I'm the most active. So it's at Jody McCallister, JodyMcallister. You can also find me on Blue Sky. I'm at Jody MCA at, you know, whatever the end of a Blue Sky handle is that I can then remember what it is.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us today and reminding us that falling in love is complicated, but the sparkle is definitely worth it.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Maybe I'll come back next year for what book could that possibly be?
I love it. I'm super excited to start reviewing the last book. I'm like, what is happening with Chess? Where would she fall in love?
No.
I don't know.
I love
it. I kind of have some ideas.
Me too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I promise you, you can figure it out. Like it's not on the surface, but it's not far below.
It's in there. She's a good little detective. And we'll be sure to include, you know, all of your socials in our show notes and where people can go to buy your book so that for listeners, you know, all you have to do is just tap, tap, and it's in your shopping cart. Like, I do love those fancy little links.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is there a particular spot where you would like listeners to purchase your book from?
Buy it from your local independent bookstore.
Yeah.
Yay.
Lovely.
Yeah. So and obviously my local independent bookstore is in Melbourne, which might be a bit far for all of you, but get it from your local indie and that would be great.
And if you go to your local bookstore, all you have to do is say, this is the ISBN, they can get it. And that's probably the best way to promote, you know, the authors. and the bookstore, absolutely. Actually. So I totally promote that. And I love that you said that. So we encourage that. And then just, we always like to remind our listeners, Val, Courtney, and I, we're like three best friends and we love to talk and give it advice. But if you are really, truly going through something that needs expert advice, we do encourage you to seek expert advice and think of us as like three best friends chatting over a cup of coffee, you know, sometimes. So we just want to make that really clear to people.
If you'd like to reach out and tell us about your book, request a book or movie review, to ask us what would you do, or to talk about your book or share relationship insights, you can reach us at www.myperfectromance.com, where you also find links to all of our socials.
And while you're there, you can tap the follow button so you don't miss any upcoming episodes, and rate and review us. We love to hear your feedback, and it'll help us make the show a little bit more special for you.
Yeah. And then coming up, I just like to give people advance notice so that you guys have an opportunity to read or watch in advance. We're going to go through year two, all of the movies, books, and kind of just talk about our favorites. And then go ahead and watch Girls Like Girls, because we're going to break that down. It was a good one. And we're going to be reviewing the book One Golden Summer and answering some of your what would you do.
But until then, keep believing in the perfect version of your own romance.
I'm Valerie.
I'm Courtney.
And I'm Lisa.
And this has been My Perfect Romance.
Happy romancing, everyone.
XOXO.
And thank you again for coming on the show tonight, Jody. It was really
thank you.
A pleasure.
Absolutely my pleasure. Anytime.